Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 22, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And the show comes out every single Friday, downloadable from our website, theretrohour.com, Stitcher, SoundCloud, YouTube, your favourite podcast client.
We're everywhere.
And we're doing pretty well at the moment, I've got to say.
Oh yes, we have been nominated. Thank you guys for your support. We are now in the top 10 category of the world's best podcast for 2016.
The votes, actually, because we did say last week we only had about 90 votes. Since then, we went up to, like, what was it in the end?
Oh, God, I think it was around 300 and something.
Yes.
We basically got to around the fourth or fifth position.
Okay.
Which is amazing. Thank you.
And considering we're up there with people like Milk the Cow podcast and Belgian Smack.
Yes. I've never heard of these other ones, but I guess this is the international one, so you're going to get the whole world's one. But we've got some friends in there as well.
We have.
Retro Asylum, who are another great podcast.
Did they win it last year?
They won the UK one.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But I think it was too late for the UK entries. We all came in too late. And RGDS as well, Retro Gaming Discussion Show.
Mm-hmm.
Retro Domination, I don't know if you know about them. They are Australian.
Okay, cool.
An Oz-based podcast.
Down Under, mate.
Down Under, yeah.
Awesome. Well, it's always nice. I mean, you're looking at the list here of the top 10 podcasts that are nominated. It's great to see, like, you know, three retro gaming podcasts in there.
Yeah, definitely. There's obviously a demand.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you haven't heard about these shows before, highly recommend that you check them out. Retro Asylum, Retro Domination, RGDS, and, of course, The Retro Hour, which you probably know because you're listening to it right now.
Yeah, and you can help us still further on in the awards, which is now it's moved on to Twitter, guys. So we're off Facebook, and if you're not good on Twitter, then just ignore this. You can put I nominate our name at Retro Hour UK for the World's Best Podcast Awards 2016.
Okay.
And that will count as a nomination and it will help towards a vote. I think it's now a group of judges
and
votes that count. So.
Well, we'll put all this information in the show notes at theretrohour.com. But if you get a minute and you're on Twitter, then that will be awesome. You know, we can go all suited and booted to the awards too.
Who do we have as a guest this week, Dan?
Well, I think we've got a rather famous pair on the show this week, Ravi.
Yeah, we've got two guys, and they are the Oliver twins.
Dizzy,
Super Robin Hood, lots of Amstrad stuff,
early
PlayStation.
Well, it's quite interesting because the Amstrad CPC was obviously a massive platform here in the UK. And we haven't really covered it a lot on the show before, but the Oliver twins, they were like, you know, these guys actually made a conscious decision to support the Amstrad CPC in its early days.
They were the British gaming brothers, weren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. And also we'll hear their early stories about how they backed the PlayStation originally and everyone said, oh, that's never going to take off.
So, yeah.
That'd be quite cool. I mean, they are, like you said, British gaming legends. Even Dizzy, it's a franchise that's known around the world as, you know,
totally.
A famous British
gaming.
And
I think they got the competitive edge being brothers.
Yeah.
You know, they could feed off each other's energy.
Absolutely. So looking forward to this one, the Oliver twins on the Retro Hour in around 20 minutes from now. And let's get into this week's news stories then. Now, Monkey Island was one of my all-time favourite games. I'd say of any genre, Monkey Island.
Fantastic game, just the atmosphere. Oh, God, so good.
What a classic. And obviously it was LucasArts, wasn't it, who made those games back in the old days.
Yeah, they got bought out by Disney recently, didn't they?
It was $4 billion they paid for it.
It's worth it.
Yeah, to be fair, they had some amazing franchises, including Monkey Island. Now, Ron Gilbert was the guy obviously originally behind the first couple of Monkey Island games and Maniac Mansion. He's actually sent a tweet this week going, "Dear Disney, now that you're not making games anymore, please sell me my Monkey Island and Maniac Mansion IPs back. I will pay real actual money for them."
Mm.
So essentially, he's offering to pay whatever Disney wants so he can have these franchises back.
Now, the question is, why does he want them back? What does he want to do with them?
Well, obviously, you know, if he's got money to pay for them, you'd think obviously he wants to use these franchises again, which I think is the exciting part of this story. Now, this has been retweeted 5,783 times at the moment.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fans are getting behind this. But, you know, I used to love the original Monkey Island games. 1 and 2 were probably my favourite point-and-click adventures of all time. And the later games came along, obviously, kind of got the 3D ones, you know, the CD-ROM games that came out, Curse and Escape of Monkey Island, all that kind of thing. Never quite the same, but I think it's because, you know, Ron Gilbert, he was at the heart and soul of the original games. He came up with the characters. And when you take that away, it kind of loses something of it, I think.
Yeah, and that I think that's the case with a lot of these people wanting to do remakes or HD versions of their old games. You know, a lot of the times these companies have sold off the rights to games to all over the place. Yeah. So the original author has to try and track it down. So it would be good to see it back in his hands.
I mean, there was a little series that came out. There was the Tales of Monkey Island that came out about 4 or 5 years ago. There were like a few mini games that came out. I don't think Ron had any involvement in that at all. As far as I know, but yeah, I mean, I played through a couple of those, but they didn't really have quite the original.
With the Pirates of the Caribbean, Disney would maybe integrate Monkey Island in something like that. They might have their own plans, you know.
Well, I've always thought that it must be based on that.
Yeah, that's
it's
what
too
everybody.
Similar.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Absolutely, must be based on that. But I mean, it would be awesome just to see maybe like a fully animated Monkey Island movie.
Well, that's one of their biggest franchises, isn't it? Pirates of the Caribbean. They have the rides of that as well, so. Mm-hmm. Might slot in well, you never know.
Or on the flip side, Disney might be like, no, it's too similar to Pirates. Yeah, we want to bury that now.
Yeah.
So more than likely that one. But yeah, what an amazing thing it would be though, to see a new Ron Gilbert Monkey Island game coming
Excellent.
Out.
Excellent. Come on, Disney.
Yeah, sort it out, Disney. So yeah, give that little retweet if you are on Twitter. I'm sure Ron will appreciate that. Now, the Neo Geo is a system that I've always drooled over since I was a kid.
I've never really played on one. I've kind of had a little fiddle, but I've never had a good time sitting down with one and, you know.
Get old Dominic Diamond on us today. but we did actually play with one at the replay show a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah. We had a little blast, but it wasn't.
We did. But yeah, it was always too expensive. And even now, collecting for the Neo Geo, the prices are extortionate for them, aren't they?
They're crazy, which makes me think this guy might be slightly crazy. But according to Motherboard on Vice, there's a guy, Brian Hargrove, and he's obsessive with the Neo Geo. So what he does is he has an algorithm or a bidding service which basically bids on anything that comes up with Neo Geo on eBay. Anything, any obscure item, anything strange.
A bell rings in his room when something comes up.
Yeah, ding, 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 go. And he's looked at this thing that kind of looked like a development piece of hardware. So, you know, naturally you just spend $750 on it, which is absolutely nuts, plugs it in, and it's a whole game.
Wow.
That had not been released for the Neo Geo that no one knew about.
And looking at this, it's a fighting game, and it actually looks quite like Street Fighter.
Yeah.
The graphics that we can see here, I mean, there's only a couple of little screenshots of like the character select screen and stuff like that. And what's interesting about this as well is, apparently he bought this off Japan's biggest auction website, which is Yahoo Auctions. You know, you had an auction website.
And basically got them on EEPROMs that came, and he had to take them off and then kind of, you know, copy the EEPROMs because he didn't want to damage the original carts and then kind of boot it off that. But, you know, he didn't know what was on these.
That's crazy, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, it is like a fantasy-themed fighting game. And there's actually a little video of him demoing it at a classic gaming convention, which is really cool.
So, and of course, it's got really good arcade graphics because it's Neo Geo.
Absolutely.
So, you know, maybe this crazy speculative collecting could lead to something.
Well, it's just awesome finding that, isn't it? I mean, you probably fair to say this guy's got the only copy in the world of that.
Yeah, you know, yeah, like, that's it. It's ultra rare because he only knows about it.
And hopefully he'll dump the ROMs so everyone can have a go.
Yeah.
So we'll keep you posted on that one. Now, this is quite an interesting topic that I saw pop up on Reddit. Are car boot sales worth it?
I would say for me, as an Amiga collector, 10 years ago they were. 15 years ago they were amazing.
Yeah.
Now, no. It's just old Xboxes everywhere, wherever I go.
Well, yeah, there's a post from a guy who's not far from us, actually. I'm currently in the Derbyshire area, he says. He wants to check out a few car boot sales around the East Midlands. However, I've not really heard much good news from others. Flea markets in the States seem a more viable option, but have you scored any good stuff from car boot sales? So I've not been to a load of car boot sales, but my missus is always like, you know, I always see computer stuff there. So I went to a couple. I've probably been to about 4 or 5 over the last, like, 5 years since I've been here. I think the oldest system I saw was a Sega Master System.
Yeah.
That was in a puddle.
That's a big problem with British car boot sales is rain. Because I've gone to one and I saw a beautiful super scope, you know, for SNES, all packaged, original and everything. Come back half an hour later, the guy's just left it out and wrecked it.
Yeah.
And it's like not even worth buying. But the main systems I found at car boot sales, because I used to go every Saturday.
Okay.
And This would be, you know, 7 in the morning.
So got to get there early.
Yeah, because the other collectors had come out. But the only stuff I kind of get would be like a Dreamcast for £2 with no cables, where the guy's like, that's not working.
Because he's lost the wire.
Well, that's it. There's no way of testing if any of these machines work at a car boot sale as well. There's no PowerPoint. You don't have a screen that you can plug it into. So you're basically just buying this in the hope that something might power up.
It's not like eBay, you can't return it. You know, the guy might not be there next weekend. But there's a guy here on this Reddit thread here. He says, I used to go to car boot sales about 10 years ago, like you said. He found a mint condition Panasonic 3DO for a tenner. A lot of good Mega Drive games, including Shining Force and Castlevania for £1 each. Yeah. He says, however you go now, and everyone tries to sell them for eBay prices.
Totally, totally. I went actually recently past, and there was an Asian family, and they had a Mega Drive 1, and it had been kept in beautiful condition, like the box and everything, but they knew the value.
Yeah.
You know, they checked on eBay, and it was out there in the front, and I was like, oh, I'm not going to buy that. I want like a Amiga PPC card for £7 or something. You know?
See, I do read stuff like that on forums, like if people are like, yeah, you know, I bought like an Amiga 4000 for £1 and stuff like that. But I've been to a few car boot sales. All I ever see is like, you know, maybe a PlayStation 2. And it's always like old copies of FIFA for the Xbox or the PS3.
If we're in England as well, where car boot sales are massively popular and Amiga was, and we can't find them, then, you know, guys in America and other places, you must be really screwed.
Someone else in here makes a really good point there. A lot of them are going home with this stuff because they're trying to charge like £70 for a Mega Drive. You put it on eBay, you're listing it out to the whole of Europe. You know, I mean, they might be interested and can bid against each other. When you're doing it at a little car boot sale on like, you know, Collett Park or whatever, it's like not quite the same, is it? So, honestly, I wouldn't waste the effort of getting up at 7 in the morning to go to car boot sales.
I think it's trends of things as well, though. So if you went, say, 5 years ago and you went to get typewriters, you'd be getting them for £2, £3, £4, just old battered typewriters. Now the hipsters, typewriter trend, you know, they're going to be going up to £40, £50.
Sitting Starbucks with it.
Yeah.
That actually leads on quite nicely to a story we'll talk about in just a moment.
Oh.
Before that, though, our first ever guest on the Retro Hour was quite a famous Amiga musician.
Yeah, Alistair Brimble, one of my favourite.
He is. What an absolute legend. Lovely bloke as well.
Yeah.
When did we first meet Alistair? Was it the Amiga 13 Amsterdam?
Yeah, I think we met him at the airport. Or we met him before, and then we had a good time at the airport eating paninis.
Yeah. And then shared a bit of pasta with him. Yeah. Very nice guy. Obviously responsible for some amazing Amiga music. Like, you know, he did Mortal Kombat music on the Amiga, didn't he?
Yeah.
Super Frog.
Super Frog Assassin, you know, he's Alien Breed. Alien Breed, yeah.
There's a really cool guy that we've chatted to a fair bit online, Paul Bridger, who's actually done a documentary all about Alistair Brimble.
And it's free to watch online as well, guys.
So. It is, so we thought we'd get Paul on just for a quick chat about the documentary. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm fine, really good.
We really don't want to get you on because, now, Alistair Brimble is an Amiga musician who's obviously responsible for some amazing Amiga music, but also very close to our hearts as well because he was the first guest that we ever had on this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I knew that you guys were doing the podcast, and I jumped onto that first episode, and it was a fantastic episode, as is all the episodes. Keep up the great work, guys. But I did listen to the first episode because I've been working quite closely with Alistair, and it was great to get some insight and, you know, find out a little bit more with what he was doing and the questions that you were probing for. So yeah, all good stuff.
You were one of his first fans, weren't you, to meet him?
Yeah, stalker. I was. I mean, I purely because it came back down to, you know, all the games that I used to play, you know, back on the Amiga days and stuff, and I still do. But, I fell in love with his music, and, you know, as soon as I was going through all the magazines and stuff, and I saw the advertisement, and I was like, I've got to get that cassette tape, and sent off for it, and I was one of the first ones to get it. The same with the Sounds digital album as well, and the Bang Tick Tick album. I was the first one to get these albums from the day of release, and just love his music. I love his work. He can change his genre to fit any kind of game, really.
Well, I was going to ask you then, actually, what's so special about Alistair Brimble's music?
When you go through the games that he's worked on in terms of, you know, sort of like the early 90s, so if you go from sort of Alien Breed, very dark, atmospheric, moody, and then you go to something like, Body Blows, and then something like Super Frog, and it's the transition. I think it was the transition that really got to me, because them samples and all that work he was putting into it was just something else. It was on a different level for me.
Well, you were involved in the Amiga Works Kickstarter.
Yeah, I managed to get the executive producer credit for that. Backed the project myself because I wanted this to be a success, and you know, spread it around like wildfire on social media and everything else. And yeah, literally got on board with Alistair. I had some time off work, and I said to him, "Look, you know, I'd love to do this for you." And that was literally starting his website up, and I created all the website, the design for it. But then I started going into more depth with it. So, you know, I was like, what else can I add to this? And started getting in contact with a few legends, you know, through the gaming community, and started getting testimonials and started adding them in. But, you know, I set everything up from the shopping cart because my main background is marketing as well. I managed to get a full track, which was Assassin, the main title, played on commercial radio as well, which very rarely happens these days, to be fair.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, they always say you should never meet your heroes, but Alistair is such a nice guy as well. I mean, do you remember when you first like started speaking to him and when you met him first time?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to him briefly online and stuff like that, but I mean, my opportunity was literally to get him to meet him at Amiga 30 UK because we're literally on, you know, very far from each other. You know, I'm up in Newcastle, he's all the way down the south coast, and there was just no way, you know, we could really get together. And yeah, I think Amiga 30 UK was fantastic, and you know, we got to meet up, and I think as soon as we met up for the first time, it was just we had that connection straight away.
Well, the Amiga Works has actually grown from just a Kickstarter project where he remade his tunes into something that we can all watch on YouTube at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, for me, I think the first thing that it's inspired me to actually do something more so than being involved with the album, and well, not so much as the album per se, but obviously with the Kickstarter project and getting the website up and running and stuff like that, was I saw Chris Hulsbeck's Turrican anthology, and that did very well. And then I saw a trailer for that on YouTube, and I thought that, you know, it looked really good, and it gave me a bit more sort of inspiration behind it. And I thought I could do something about this. And, you know, knowing my history and my experience through with video, I just thought myself, you know, let's try it. And it started off, really, to be fair, is a kind of a mini trailer to the actual album, and it just spiraled out of control. It just went wildfire, and I think it was because, you know, I was getting so much testimonials and feedback and some really good support, but that support has really taken quite a bit of time. So you're talking 2 years in the making, really.
We kind of were amazed when we watched it because you had so many really good guests, you know, proper prominent musicians like Chris Hulsbeck and, you know, many others. It's really good film.
Chris Hulsbeck was probably one of the last ones that I managed to get onto that project. And he's a hard man to reach. I had a laugh because he actually turned around and said, you know, Paul, he says, I admire your persistence, you know, I'm going to do this for you. And it paid off. But, you know, there's other guys that were willing to bend over backwards and help me. I mean, the Oliver twins, those guys were fantastic. They set up a green screen for me, and I just did all the tinkering behind the background, you know, and that was it.
And Ravi and I are in it as well, but don't let that put you off if you're thinking of checking out this documentary.
Well, the one that has been released on YouTube is literally the cut-down version. There is an extended version, which I am going to spread at some point, because it has got some additional bits in there, which I think the fans will like. So I am releasing an extended version, and there's also going to be an alternative version for another project as a perk, possibly later on the year. So watch this space.
Excellent, Paul. So if people want to check it out, if you haven't seen it yet, where do they go?
So at the moment, it is literally on YouTube. You know, just search for Amiga Works, Alistair Brimble, you know, and you'll literally find it. It's just as quick as that. But yeah, I mean, we've got the official Amiga Works Facebook page as well. We've got updates and all sorts on there as well. So, you know, catch her out on there as well.
And we'll share the links in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Yeah. Paul, been lovely talking to you.
Yeah, and you as well. And keep up the great work. It's been fantastic listening to all the episodes.
Now, a moment ago, we were talking about car boot sales and eBay stuff. You mentioned typewriters. This has got to be up there in the most bizarre eBay finds that I've ever seen. A secret German World War II code machine has been found on eBay.
Thank you for Byron Hawkins for submitting this news to us. And this is crazy. We were talking about the Enigma machine the other day.
At Bletchley Park, yeah.
At Bletchley Park, yeah. And this is a ciphering machine as well that Hitler used to communicate with his personal high command.
Right.
Now, this appeared on eBay for £9.50. And it seemed to be labelled as a teleprinter. Yeah, so the guys at Bletchley were like, what the hell? This is amazing. So they went to the guy's house and gave him a tenner for it.
Yeah.
Went into his shed, and in the corner, covered in dirt and everything, was this machine. And it's supposed to be more complicated than the Enigma and more important.
No way. Well, looking at this, it does look like, you know, a very advanced typewriter. Actually, looks a bit like a roll of, like, till receipt or something on the side of it.
That yeah, because, you know, it's a ciphering machine, so all the little wheels and cogs turn to create this code.
That is absolutely crazy, isn't it? Just for that to show up for like less than a tenner. Did they actually tell the guy what it is, I wonder, then?
I'm not sure, but maybe they said come and see it in the museum afterwards, you know. But it's gone to the right people. I'm very glad that Bletchley got this and somebody didn't get it and try to make money from it.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Well, apparently they had like their team of experts working on it. They've restored it now to working order and
excellent
stuff.
Excellent, good stuff.
Thanks, everyone. Bletchley Park. There's a rare bit of history that you can look at that turn up in the most unlikely places. Now, before we get to the Oliver twins, I was just watching this really cool video. Now, it was posted a couple of years ago, but it's actually Sega introducing the world's first hologram game, Time Traveller, back in the year 1991. And I got a proper nostalgic blast from the past watching this. I was like, oh my God, I remember playing that. You know, there are certain games that, like, really made an influence on you then you just completely forget about.
Yeah.
This was a game that came out. I recall this game was, it's obviously pure novelty. It had, like, a few little bits of sponge in the background. And then it's, like, kind of projected a hologram image into the middle of this kind of...
It's like kind of back projected onto this weird dome. And then it's like, you know, when you had early CD-ROM games and they just shoved video of people in? Because the CGI was so bad, you'd kind of have a digitized person. Well, that's what it's like.
It's FMV game, and I've watched this video, and an 8, 9, 10-year-old kid, whatever it was when it came out, I always recall the acting being shocking back then and thinking, God, they can't act to save their lives. But for some reason, it brought back a weird memory of, like, near me when I was a kid, we used to have a fair that visited every year, and this game was in there, which, you know, it must have been state of the art at the time.
Well, I'm just looking at the development video here, and there's kind of the green screen on the back they've just painted on the wall.
Yeah.
So it must be really early kind of chroma key.
Well, 1991 it came out, yeah. And, you know, I imagine these were probably pretty expensive. But if you've never played the game before, it's essentially kind of like you said, there's early FMV games, like, you know, Mad Dog McCree, do you remember that?
Yeah.
And it is another cowboy kind of shooter thing. But what I remember about this, watching this video, is if you, like, shoot and you miss or you die, it just kind of restarts that bit of the scene again. So literally the cowboy was walk in, miss, walk out, walk in, miss. You'll do it about 20 times.
Oh, was it just like a trigger?
Yeah.
A trigger event game?
It is just like that. You get certain bits of the game where you've got to press buttons and stuff. But yeah, just looking at that, I mean, it's certain games that, you know, at the time I remember putting my hand through the character and thinking, oh my God, this is amazing. All games are going to be like this one day.
Yeah.
And obviously, I think they made a sequel, but that was never really seen anywhere. But saying about them, they did some really cool stuff. I also remember one called the R360. That was kind of like a flight sim kind of game. You'd sit inside it, and it was actually mechanical. It was like a ride, and you'd spin round backwards and everything. And like,
where was this that you saw?
It's at the seaside. I saw that, but I think it was about £3.50 to go on, like Scarborough or something. So, but Sega did some pretty cutting edge stuff back in the day.
Yeah, that's crazy. All I remember was Silent Scope.
But, I mean, yeah, the arcades are always, like, you know, where Sega, like, really, really excelled back in the old days, I think. So
totally, that was it, the arcade realism.
Worth a look. It's just an interesting bit of gaming history. We'll pop a link to this video in the show notes at theretrohour.com. And thank you for checking out episode number 22. Of course, do keep your votes coming in on Twitter.
Yeah, we need your votes, and hopefully we'll win.
And you can check out the show every single Friday, of course. We'll be back next week. You can download it every week from theretrohour.com, iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, YouTube, all your favourite places. And for the next 40 minutes or so on the Retro Hour, I've been looking forward to this one.
We have the absolute legendary Oliver Brothers. My childhood heroes. Dizzy, we love you.
Let's talk Dizzy.
Yay.
And we'll see you next Friday.
See you next Friday.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's our pleasure to welcome to this week's show two absolutely legendary British game developers, Philip and Andrew Oliver, the Oliver twins. So we'll start right at the beginning, guys. What first got you into computers?
Hi, Dan and Ravi. So, Philip here. Our first computer experience, I guess, was back in the 79-80 era.
Space Invaders, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, Space Invaders in a local supermarket. That colour game where they managed to get colour by sticking coloured cellophane on the screen of a black and white game.
We were just mesmerised by the fact that you could sort of control things on the TV, because up to then, we just had a couple of channels on the telly, and we don't read books and stuff, so we literally got sort of really bored and used to play board games because we were that bored. and the idea that you could actually have competitions and gameplay on a TV, we were just mesmerised. We were about 11, 12, something like that, and this just opened up our worlds to something that was truly incredible.
Well, you guys were obviously there, you know, in the first UK microcomputer boom of the early 80s. So what was it like kind of growing up in that era?
Isolated in some ways. I mean, the point to us that you didn't really know anybody else that was kind of into it. Occasionally, you'd find somebody at school.
There were geeky friends.
Yeah.
There were a few geeky friends who kind of, we liked technology and we all thought, hey, this is really kind of cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the best one was a friend of ours, Ivan. His dad had an Apple IIe that he'd really got because he was kind of a science teacher. But actually, the games on that were cracking. So they had Zork and Night Mission and Taxman and things like that. And so we used to go around his house all the time playing on his dad's Apple IIe.
So how did you guys end up saving up or getting your first machine?
Well, the first machine was a funny story. It was actually our brother, our older brother's machine. He decided, he's, 7 years older than us, and he decided that with his sort of...
He just got a job.
He got some money, so he thought he'd buy a computer. So he actually bought a ZX81, but it was secondhand. And I remember sort of going around the guy's house sort of with Martin to buy it. And Martin sort of said, well, why are you selling this computer secondhand?
And because it's so new, because it had only been out a few months.
And it's like, why would he sell it secondhand? This is amazing. He goes, oh, well, I'm going to buy myself a different computer, a BBC Micro Model A. I was just there thinking, well, this is really dumb.
A computer's a computer.
It's like, what are you doing? It's like, this is really dumb. Of course, we quickly discovered that a computer is not all computers are equal. And when he got it home and put it under the TV, he was busy with girlfriends and work and everything else. So he kind of left it under the family TV.
And we just played around with it because we were bored. And there's a few type-in listings because it used to come with manuals, and there were times where you'd actually read the manual because you go, well, it doesn't do anything. So open up the manual and there'll be little 10-line listings. You type it in and go, oh, that's quite interesting.
And if you try line 11, you run out of memory because it only had 1K.
Yeah, typing on that lovely chiclet keyboard as well.
Yeah, I mean...
paper keyboard is rubbish.
I mean, literally it would have this sort of 10, hello world, 20 go to 10, and then the next one might be, like, a few pages in would be, like, getting a little tiny cursor to just bounce around the screen. And it was just kind of fascinating to us, like, how it worked. And
it was magical just being able to control the image on the TV. I mean, everybody kind of takes it for granted now, but back in those days, you really only had broadcast TV, and the TV did just what the channel was kind of showing. And so to actually be able to sort of control it and put letters on the screen and sort of type 10, hello world, 20, go to 10 and go, hey, look, I could get it to print hello world a million times. Agreed. But the good stuff happened when we actually upgraded. So in August of 82, we saved up, we did a paper round and saved up and bought a Dragon 32. Ooh. Now this had 32K of memory, a proper keyboard, color graphics,
operating system by Microsoft.
It did.
Even though it was made by Mattel.
It was actually really, really similar to a Tandy machine. I think Tandys were very popular in America. It's actually really similar, we discovered.
But it was kind of good and bad in the fact that it was good for all the things we just said, and the language was basic, but it had sprite commands and little turtle language, so you could like program like a spirograph patterns and things. Really, really simply. But it was bad in the fact it had no games.
Because it wasn't a very popular machine.
Because it was so damn obscure and nobody wrote games for it. But actually, looking back on it, whilst we felt that we'd probably bought the wrong computer because we couldn't get any games, we had to make our own. And that actually helped us, that we spent our time just saying, well, there's no games out there, or the few that we found were so bad that we could almost write that ourselves.
Well, I was going to say, because I also grew up with quite an obscure machine as my first computer. I had a Commodore Plus 4. That was my first machine.
So that is obscure.
I can relate to you guys, you know, the lack of software and stuff like that. But was there any other machines that you kind of looked at the time and lusted over and thought, you know, I wish we had one of those?
We had the choice. When our older brother had this ZX81, and we'd put all our time and effort into this, and we decided we wanted a proper computer now that we understood why you needed a better one. So there was the model...
BBC Model B.
The BBC Model B was being talked about. There was obviously the VIC-20, and then the Commodore 64, and there was the Spectrum. So we actually had the choice, at the point of buying that Dragon, we had the choice of a Spectrum just being released. I think it would have been 16K, which would have kind of...
But it looked like a nasty keyboard.
But it didn't look much better than the ZX81, and it was 16K of memory, so 32K beat it on the Dragon. The BBC was just a ridiculous price.
Well, it was £400, which would in today's money be well over £1,000.
Which in dollars, we're talking more. Almost $2,000 or something.
Yeah,
it's crazy money.
It was crazy money. And the way in which they managed to sell it was because they got it into all the schools as the sort of main research teaching machine. So it must have been expensive. I don't know whether they got subsidized. But the fact is, the rich kids' parents would be sort of sold the idea, this isn't for games. This is for your homework. This is what they teach in the schools now. This is going to be the standard. And there was even a BBC program supporting it. So on TV, they were teaching you how to program the computer, which was incredible. Look back on it. I mean, you can find the clips on YouTube. They're hilarious.
It was the best machine, but also ridiculously expensive. So that was out of the league. VIC-20, weren't really keen on the style of it. It just didn't look very nice. And so we weren't that taken with Or the C64. In fact, the C64, we actually thought, mistakenly, but this is because quite young, naive kids, we thought they'd just put some more memory in the VIC-20 and change the colour
right.
The plastic. Because that's the way it was marketed, that's what it appeared to be. They basically didn't kind of promote the fact that this is actually a much more advanced machine.
So how did this lead to you guys start programming? Were you learning from books or... the television or other places?
It was
the manuals themselves.
And the magazines. There was quite a fascinating hobby thing going on at the time where they wanted to do computer magazines, and the computer magazines would review the games that came out on any format, but there weren't that many games coming out. So it would be adverts, reviews of games, and what do we fill the rest of the magazine with? And they just went down the line of...
Type in listings,
and it was very common that every magazine would always have sort of a few type in listings, and so we would diligently sort of you'd read your magazine from, because
cover to cover
you've got a month, and this is the magazine that you've got, so you type in every listing there, and you spend your time sort of trying to understand it to fix it, because when you type it in, you always have all the syntax errors. So we learned it all through that. Now, that's basic, but it does teach you all the fundamentals of programming. So we understood how it all worked. Obviously, it took a little bit of a leap to go into assembler. But we were a year or two in, we won a national competition, and, slightly wrong word, but we did get a BBC Micro.
Eventually.
And the BBC was wonderful in the fact that in BASIC, you could write assembler and BASIC alongside each other, which was just genius. And so, obviously, every time we tried to write something and it was a bit slow, you try to work out how to write it in assembler. And in the manual, it explained how to do this.
Yeah, the first bit of assembler we actually wanted to do was that we couldn't get any decent graphics. We wanted to create little games, but we needed to create the graphics of the little Pac-Man sprites and stuff like that. But we couldn't actually draw the graphics on the screen in any way. So we needed an art package. So we decided to write ourselves an art package.
Well, everyone did it on graph paper.
Everybody sort of did graph papers and trying to work out hex codes from graph paper. But we thought, no, let's work out a little program which kind of can draw pictures. We can draw the pictures using all the tools.
Well, I know after the BBC, I know you guys had quite a bit of an affinity for the Amstrad machines. Is that right?
So what actually happened and why we went to the Amstrad was that we were writing games and starting to get quite good at writing games on the BBC, but nobody wanted to publish them and give us money for them. So we thought, well, these are really good quality games. Why won't anybody give us any money for them and publish them? Because that was kind of the next challenge, was to get them all published. But actually what happened was that the BBC was such an expensive machine, and mostly owned by schools, that not a lot of people were buying games, which means all the publishers had pulled out of publishing on them.
There was the interesting thing. So Acornsoft was pretty much the main publisher and the only publisher, and they just had a series of arcade games which were exact rip-offs. I mean, this is funny because none of them were licensed, of all the classic arcade
Defender games. And Scramble and Pac-Man and Mystery.
Yeah, so they just copied everything. And then they had a couple of unbelievable classics like Elite and Rebs and Aviator and Sentinel. And they were just like, oh my God, that whole 3D thing, it was just like, we just didn't get that at all. It was like, that was just mind-blowing. So we were like, well, we can't compete with them.
And nobody really wants to publish our games anyway. So,
but we felt that we'd be able to write the quality of games that were on the spectrum. But there's all the spectrum had been out by a couple of years by now.
And it was quite a flooded market.
And we thought, well, we don't really compete and we don't really want to go backwards, because it felt like a backward step going from a BBC Micro B to a tiny little spectrum with a horrible keyboard.
But we did
all those rubber keys.
Yeah, so, but then
Amstrad had
Lord Alan Sugar bought out the Amstrad machine, and we thought, that looks pretty cool. And the thing that really was interesting is the fact that it had a disk drive.
So this is the second Amstrad machine. The first one was just a cassette, and that was okay, and we'd kind of seen that, and that was quite a popular machine, and it was coming on well. But then we heard they were releasing the disk drive version, and we thought, ah, that's great, we're in. There aren't too many games. The machine's quite successful. We think with the disk drive, it'll be even more successful. We think that will be a really good games machine.
Well, I heard you guys even use the Amstrad to code Speccy games to avoid using that rubber keyboard. Is that correct?
Yep.
Is absolutely what happened. So what actually happened was we'd written a few games on the Amstrad and we'd got paid okay. They didn't go particularly well. We then had our big breakout hit, which was Super Robin Hood on the Amstrad, when we met the Darlings, Codemasters. And that went straight to number one. It was hugely successful. We did it in a month, the whole game and stuff. And we were like, man, this is good. But then we started writing the next game, and Codemasters hired somebody else to write to convert Super Robin Hood to Spectrum. And they seemed to be really slow and asking loads of questions and stuff. And we started into Ghost Hunters, and David Darling just sent us a Spectrum in the post and said, why don't you do it yourself, guys? And we're like, yeah, it's kind of Z80 based. And so this machine had just turned up and we're like, maybe, but we don't really want to type on it and it doesn't have a disk drive. So maybe if we could just cable it to the back of the Amstrad, when then we can write the game on the Amstrad, and then we'll just push it, a ROM image, effectively, down the cable, and the thing will work. At the time, it was a bit of a pipe dream and a bit of a kind of nobody really knew about this stuff, and it was just an idea. And by complete coincidence, we were talking to an electronics guy who was at Bath University about this, and he said, oh, well, yeah, that'll work, yeah, not a problem.
Computers together.
I can do that for you. Yeah, I'll knock up a little board, little sort of breadboard, and sort of soldered wires on and everything. I'll do that for you. We're like, really? That's very nice of you. Thank you. So anyway, he knocked us up this one board. His name was David Jones, but he's not the David Jones behind Lemmings. There are too many David Joneses in this world. He knocked up that one board, and basically we were able to connect the back of the Amstrad straight to the back of the Spectrum. We were able to compile using Maxam and the Amstrad and the disk drive and just spit down a ROM image onto the Spectrum, and then just test it.
Which actually was genius, because apart from the fact we didn't have to type on the horrible keyboard.
Or use a cassette recorder.
If it ever crashed or anything, you were still looking at the listing on your TV for the
On
the Amstrad, you still had the code and everything was running. So your Spectrum just crashed, so you just sort of hit the reset button.
Hit reset on that.
You look at the line of code, change the line of code, bang, straight there,
well,
again.
Yeah, it's a bit slower than that. Took a couple of minutes to compile and send it down again.
It was pretty quick. Whereas we heard other people who were trying to actually program Spectrum using a Spectrum, and it was like, how do you do that?
That would be so hard.
Because you've got to have your source code and the final code in memory at the same time. And what happens when it crashes and locks up? It's like, well, you just reload everything. That'll take ages. And they go, yeah, you just make sure you don't do it. You just like be really super careful. Well, we don't be careful. We just like just throw it down. If it crashes,
And the really good news was, one, we didn't pay for the spectrum, which is really good, but it took us about 2 weeks from getting that spectrum to get the first game running, which is Ghost Hunters. It took about 2 weeks to write it, and we're straight to number one. It's not bad, is it?
So we were just thinking, oh, this is brilliant. Now, you could say that we slightly compromised things, and people did criticise us at the time, because they said, you put your Amstrad into the same mode, which was the same pixel resolution as the Spectrum, and obviously it was capable of doing more. I think actually we made this when we did Grand Prix Simulator, we put it into a full color mode,
and then we couldn't do that on the Spectrum,
and then we realized we couldn't convert it to the Spectrum quite so easily.
So somebody else got that job.
So somebody else converted it, and we thought, oh, we really made a mistake. So from that day on, like every game that we did, we put it into the mode that
on the Amstrad
that pretty much emulated the Spectrum.
And then on the C64, the people who were converting our games to the C64 put the C64 into a mode that emulated the Spectrum as well.
you never had to learn those little shortcut keys on the Spectrum keyboard then.
Do you know what? There's a funny story. We were best selling kind of authors on the Spectrum, and a friend of ours sort of said, "Oh, would you go around my sort of nephew's house and basically say hi? He can't believe that I know the Oliver Twins and all this, and maybe sign a couple of cassettes for him." So anyway, we said, yeah, fine, we'll just nip round his house. It's not a problem. It wasn't that far away. So we drove round, and we're just chatting to him, and he was a bit sort of starstruck and all this. And then we go, "So have you got any questions for us?" And he goes, "Yeah, how do I get this word on the keyboard?"
Because there was, you had to press Control Shift Alt function this.
And the funny thing was,
We didn't know. And we were like, I don't honestly know. And we were like there trying to go, well, is it that key and that key? And he was like, guys, you've written loads of games on the Spectrum. How do you not know the sellers? How do you not know how the keyboard works? And it's like, because we use ZX, K and M, I think, up, down, left, right.
That's the ones we use.
Spacebar or something for fire or jump. And we were like, literally, we don't know how to type on this keyboard.
And the funny thing is, I mean, we've been doing research recently for this book that's being written, The Oliver Twins.
The Story of the Oliver Twins.
Yep. And we're doing lots of research, and I basically keep everything in my loft. The problem with keeping everything is actually then finding it, because it wasn't very well catalogued. But I have spent a lot of time cataloguing absolutely everything. So we found everything, all source code to everything, all source notes and design documents, and every letter, every business card. We ran everything. It's taken a while, and the author who was actually writing the book, he just can't believe the ton of stuff that he got.
So do you think being twins leads to kind of an advantage and being able to remember this stuff and working together?
We were competitive in like playing these early games, who can get the highest score and who can sort of get to the next level. And then we turned that into a slightly more constructive of like, who could write code, which the other one goes, how the bloody hell did you do that?
And you can brainstorm a little bit as well.
And you're at exactly the same level. So you've got this concept where you've got a challenge in front. Sometimes you put the challenges in front of yourself. I wonder if this is possible. Well, the other person who's alongside you knows why that's a challenge. There's this whole concept that if a kid at home is writing something and says to his mum and dad, look at this, I've done something really clever, they'll go, oh, yes, love, that's really nice, that's wonderful. They have no idea what the hell he's done.
Yeah.
They don't know if it's clever. They're just trying to be sympathetic
and supportive,
but they don't know. But we are exactly at the same level. We know the challenge, and the challenge is just beyond, because we haven't done it before, just beyond us. We both understand, and one manages to do it before the other one. You go, oh, that is actually quite clever. So go on, how did you do it? And then when you do get stuck, obviously, you can talk about it and explain and go, well, I did it like this. And you go, oh, actually, that's pretty smart.
Well, you mentioned your parents in there as well. I mean, I think, you know, my mum and dad, when I was a kid, I'd spend that much time in front of the computer. They'd be like, you know, trying to encourage me to go out and play sometimes. But
we had all of that.
What did they think of your coding obsession then?
No, they absolutely thought we were obsessed with coding, which they thought was a bad thing. But on the other hand, the minute we started sort of making sort of some money and getting a bit of a name for ourselves, that was all like, oh, actually, you're really good at this. That's fantastic. But before that, there was a little bit of skepticism.
When we were about 14, 15, we won a TV competition. It was a national TV competition to design a game. And we won it partly because we actually wrote a game as opposed to design it. Everyone else sort of just designed on paper what would be a good idea for like a little arcade game.
Which 99% of the time, those competitions, they just describe another game they've just played.
Yeah. we'd actually written a game. It wasn't a very good game, but we've written it and we've won the competition. So we at school were labelled as geeks and the people who knew how computers work. There was the air that computers are the future. There was this general
consensus. There was also the air that the computers are going to do everybody out of jobs. They're going to kill people. Terminator had just come out, obviously.
Yeah, and generally, games were just a fad. And so our parents, I think, were really supportive in the fact that computers were the future and we were fascinated by them and we were getting them working. And hey, they'll write a few games, they'll learn some things, and then they'll get proper jobs. So I think there was a lot of that sort of thing that they kind of accepted that we were just learning. They didn't actually think we'd write games for a living. I mean, that'd be crazy.
Until you got to number one, and lots of checks came through, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what happened? I mean,
that changed people's opinions.
We finished our sixth form high school, and we were kind of like supposed to go off to university, but at that point, the only computers at universities were sort of database programming.
Big mainframes, and no graphics.
There was, literally no graphics. And it's they didn't have these home micro type things kind of at universities. That's just wrong. And so we couldn't find any courses that sort of taught what we wanted to go into, because we went along to various interviews and things of computer programming courses, and they were like, oh, I don't want to do that stuff. That's really boring.
No, don't you have any Spectrums here? And you mentioned games. I mean, it was an abuse of computing power to use them for graphics and games. Mm. I mean, that's how everybody felt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did demean their power. But it was actually our teacher who talked to our parents and saying, look, these guys are really into these games. Why don't you let them just have a year out? Because
like, get it out of their system.
Yeah, that was it. It was get it out of their system. So, so we had a year out. We were absolutely committed. And I think our dad sort of said, well, yeah, good luck, lads. And he was always very supportive, but thinking, they'll realise that you can't actually make a living out of this.
And he did actually say, which was really funny, he said, look, if you can make more than me as in a salary in a year... And he had a
He
had a pretty good job. He goes, well, then we'll say no more about it.
The challenge is on.
Yes, you'll never need to go to university. So we never did.
And we never did find out what that number was that we were looking for. But the fact that at the end of a year, we were pulling in the money then.
So it was the September, which is the time that all of our friends had all gone off to their university courses. So all of our friends disappeared. And we were just stuck at home with our parents. We were on this challenge of like, you've got to write some games. So it was at the same time that we met the Darlings, who were just setting up Codemasters, and they said that they would pay like £10,000 for a game, which we couldn't believe, because at that point we'd only ever got hundreds. Mm-hmm. It's like 10,000. So, and that's why we ran away and wrote Robin Hood in a month. And it was quite easy because we had no distractions. We didn't have school. That was a big distraction. And we didn't have friends. That was a big distraction. and we lived at home. So we just spent literally every waking hour writing games. And you get that first game that you write, like, seriously, went to number one. And it was like, oh, my God.
That worked.
And everyone
Let's do that again.
And everyone just said, well, that was a bit lucky. And it was like, well, hang on. So we had to prove it, that we could do it again.
Well, being from Nottingham, I mean, we love Robin Hood, obviously. Why did you choose the legend of Robin Hood for your game, then?
So the thing was that what we kind of discovered was we had to get serious about making sure that we got some money in, because our dad was going to throw us out to university if we weren't careful. So we were thinking, right, what can we write that will be very commercially successful? What is it that people are going to buy? So we were kind of studying the charts and looking at the start charts and looking at the shops and going, what's selling? And the big game at the time was Ghostbusters on the Commodore 64. Mm-hmm. That was the number one, and it'd gone ballistic. And we were like, right, what we need is a name like that.
It was
a really, really popular name, because people are buying this, not because of the gameplay, because we looked at the game. We thought the game looked pretty rubbish. I know a lot of CC4 owners will actually argue with that.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
but
we thought it looked pretty rubbish.
So looking at the charts, we could see there were various arcade conversions.
That you'd all recognise.
And then there was sort of the Xeviuses and a few sort of like really wacky sort of made up words and stuff. And we were like, well, what the hell is that? And you look down and go, what's that? And it's like, well, marketing, you must need marketing to market something like really obscure.
Yeah.
Or you buy a license to an arcade thing, which we're not going to do.
We can't afford a license. We don't know how to buy a license.
And then obviously the film license thing was just starting to take off. And we were like, well, we don't know anyone in Hollywood, clearly. So we were thinking, well, what you want to do is make sure that somebody knows what the game is.
Well, and is there a license out there for free, basically?
And we sort of had always joked about Disney always had licenses for free because they did Snow White and Cinderella and stuff. They never paid any money. And it's like they were big names before they started. So we just thought, well, we don't necessarily want to go down the fairy tale route. We were just trying to think of other things. And we suddenly thought, Robin Hood, it's clear that you're a hero. Great. So you've got one obvious main character that's a hero. It's obvious the weapons he'll have because he'll use a bow and arrow. And it's obvious the locations you'll put him in. It's castles. And it's like, you can do that.
And I reckon we got to rescue Maid Marian.
Yeah. And you've got it ticks all the boxes. Everyone knows exactly what it is. Sounds kind of cool. It's achievable on the spectrum stuff because you can draw sort of a side-on view of a castle with the various platforms and steps and the turrets and... things and obvious enemies of guards and soldiers all over the place.
Well, a couple of years later, obviously, you did do licensed games, including you mentioned Ghostbusters there. You did Ghostbusters 2.
Did Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, was that exciting to work on?
A few years later, there was a film, Ghostbusters 2, and Activision, via an agent, contacted us and said, would you like to write the game? It's like, absolutely. That's exactly what we'd like to write.
Was it exciting to work on that game then?
Slightly weird.
Yeah, you kind of. I was going to say that. What is it? If you get to know your heroes, it undoes the magic.
It certainly does.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've worked for Disney quite a bit as well.
you kind of have this better image from the outside. And the minute you see the inside, you go...
It's just a mess.
It's just a complete mess. How does this all work? So for a start, they sent us a script. Kind of didn't make a lot of sense because scripts have to be in plain font with no drawings and sketches. And
yeah, film scripts are really odd. They only use typewriters to this day.
Yeah.
We've still had up to a few years ago when we were still doing, you get scripts for films and it's like they're just
only one font is allowed and they're not allowed to properly describe scenes. You can't add any graphics and all that. And
they're really odd.
So you get that and that's a bit of a letdown. So this script turns up and it's Ghostbusters. So you go, oh! And they go, oh, this is the most boring document I've ever seen.
And you get an idea and you kind of can you can make it up and go, right, well, it's got all the main characters and actors and I can see how it's all going to work. So you set about...
And then you ask for lots of images and you get very, very little come back.
We got a few photos. Yeah, there wasn't much at all. But then you sort of... We designed the game out with...
Forcefield.
With Forcefield, who were working on the ST and Amiga at that point.
Yes,
and the Commodore 64 version. And it was decided the first level would be based on this whole opening sequence of the film, which was going down into the sewers. And it's quite a big scene, and it shows the first ghosts. And so we wrote the whole first level based on this synopsis of a big action-packed opening scene. And then it was decided in a late edit of the film.
Well, I think we only learned when we actually saw the film ourselves.
We went to the Empire Cinema in London, Leicester Square,
for the premiere.
And it was like the scenes
they've knocked the scene out.
It was kind of there, but they had decided, whether it was a saving budget or whatever, to not really put this big ghost scenario in the opening sequence.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a time where, like, James Bond always starts with a massive opening sequence and then it slows down and then it builds up the pace over time. And that was generally the format. And we're going, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And then when you see the film, they'd obviously decided somewhere down the lines to change that scenario. And so it made our first level really weird. And that's happened in multiple games.
Oh, it happened
in
all
films.
So will you guys be watching the new Ghostbusters movie?
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. I understand that...
it's the worst rated trailer of all time.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
No, but there's a funny thing there. I mean, the point is that if you take something that is so...
Sacred and classic.
Yeah, sacred and classic, that people almost... Nobody can do this film justice and all this. But look, it's entertainment at the end of the day. And actually, I think the fact that it's getting attention, even though it's negative, I think all those people will go and watch it, and we're going to go and watch it, and we're going to enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm...
I watched the trailer, I thought it was pretty good.
I think it will be fun enough to watch. I look back, because we all do, at our fond childhood times of seeing some of these classics. That's why you got a retro channel. You sort of like, and you're thinking, oh no, don't ruin it. It's like, look, put the old film, that's a classic, it stands on its own.
And, it's saved. It's not like anybody's going to delete it.
Yeah, and you're kind of like thinking, well, the new one will be entertaining. I think it's going to be very, very cringy. And I'll think, oh, gee, they could have done something a little bit better than that. But given that some of the actors are dead and stuff, it's like, look, things move on. It will be a unique offering.
It'll be fun.
Yeah. Fun entertainment.
I was going to say that. So I've got three daughters, and I'm sure that if I show them the original Ghostbusters, in fact, they know the original Ghostbusters anyway. But if I show them the original one and I show the new one, they'll say, well, the new one's much better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's right for their generation.
Maybe you'll make the Ghostbusters 3 game?
Well, we're not into making games of films anymore, so we're just making a one big game.
Yeah, you know what we're making. We're making Sky Saga, and that's pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. That's us.
We'll do it the other way around. We'll make the film of the game rather than the game of the film.
Yeah, in fact, Hollywood will become knocking on our door before too long, wanting to make the movie of the game.
Yeah, so. I mean, we...
That's the ultimate goal, isn't it?
Yeah, we've seen it happen with a few. Obviously, some have been a little bit of a disaster, like the Mario game, but obviously Angry Birds is just coming out. Although, I did see recently that they're just making a film of Tetris, and it's like...
What?
Sorry.
Well, it's like, we like Tetris and all, but...
Well, one film we all want to see is the Dizzy film.
Oh, don't even.
Can we talk about your most famous franchise, Dizzy Egg?
Absolutely, yeah. It took quite a long time to get to that. Considering, obviously, we're very, very proud of it, and it's brilliant that everyone has very fond memories and is being remembered as such a classic. Although, to be fair, perfectly honest, we did make quite a lot of them and did exploit it slightly. But that's because... People kept wanting to buy them. We were having fun making them. And we would have gone absolutely stir crazy if it hadn't been for the fact that we deliberately alternated. We didn't just like suddenly turn our lives into Dizzy.
We do one Dizzy game, then one something else. And one Dizzy game, then one something else.
Yeah, but we kept on going back to Dizzy, going, well, because it's stories and it's in a fantasy world, you can keep on just making completely new stories. Whereas I've always thought that if someone's sort of making like a racing game or something, he's like,
or a football manager, or football, where
do you take it? Yeah, like FIFA, like, come on. Now, without change, like, I know that you can change the colours of the strips and the names of the people, but apart from that, what do you bring new to each one that you do? And the only thing they can bring new to it is a bit new tech to make it a bit smoother and stuff, but even that is plateauing out now because the computers aren't changing that much. So there's certain things where you can't do much more with, but if you do something that's all fantasy and story driven, then you can keep on bringing new and fresh things to it
forever.
So we were sort of really into it, sort of keep going with Dizzy, and it was very popular.
Well, the main element that I liked in Dizzy was the kind of puzzling and the exploration in it that many other platforms wouldn't have at the time. You know, having to open a door with a key and having to look for certain items.
Well, we'd started on some of these text adventures like Zork.
Yeah.
And I was a big fan of Monkey Island and Leisure Suit Larry and a few things like that.
Well, they came after Disney.
Was it? I think it was about the same sort of time. But anyway, there were various adventures, whether they be text.
I'm going to Google that.
Okay. Okay.
There
were definitely text adventures. Okay, I'm not sure Monkey whether those Island. Point and click adventures were out.
Yeah, we'd played Text Adventures.
Yeah, and then we'd played all the Spectrum games, which were just sets of keys to open doors. And we were like, oh, man, that's so bland. But the point is, it was kind of a gameplay that worked. But I know the memory is limited on a Spectrum, but you don't have to have every graphic a key and every graphic a door. So effectively, Dizzy was just key and door, but we just made sure that keys weren't drawn as keys and doors weren't drawn as doors. And that became...
See, I was right, sorry. Monkey Island, power of the internet, released in 1990.
Okay,
and was in... Well, we developed in 86 and it came out in early 87.
Okay, Monkey Island was a classic anyway.
It was.
But there were some adventure games that we've been playing that had really driven the story and the interesting ideas of puzzles. And then
they were all text adventures.
And then there were platform games which were just key and door, and you had to find. And we just thought, you need to mix these up a bit so that you got a story.
Well, Dizzy, obviously, you know, to this day, still an icon for British gaming. I mean, how do you feel about creating a character with such mass global appeal?
We're very proud of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very nice whenever anybody ever references and talks about it. What was sad that it all came to an end, that was all very sad.
Yeah, a bit gutted about that. But that's just life. But you can read more about it in the book.
Well, I was going to ask what happened with Wonderland, Dizzy.
Oh, that was interesting because as we fell out with Codemasters, there was obviously games in development.
That never got released.
That never got released. And that was a Nintendo game. And Nintendo games had to be published on cartridges. So they were quite expensive. And there's the whole production of cartridges. And there was the whole legal issues surrounding the fact that Codemaster games were non-licensed and Nintendo were taking them to court. So it didn't get released because of political issues, and we kind of forgotten about
it. We'd just completely forgotten about it, and it was only when we were at a retro fair and doing a talk on stage that I'd pulled out one of these props, and it's like, oh, here's a map for a game called Wonderland Dizzy. Now, and I sort of like, well, that rings a bell, but did it ever get released? And I actually asked the audience, it's like, guys, did that one get released? It's like, and so we ended up passing the map around the audience, and we stepped off stage and said,
that's really weird, actually, because it's like, well, what else is in the sort of boxes that you find with that map? And we, lo and behold, we sort of found some stuff that said Masters. It's actually Source Code Masters, which is a bit of a git.
Yeah, it was.
Otherwise, we'd have been able to run it on an emulator. So
we had to find somebody that could actually recompile from Source Code. But there was a guy called Lucas Kerr in Poland who's on the Dizzy website, the yokefolk.com, that reckoned that if we gave him the Source Code, he'd be able to recompile it. Then enabled us to sort of put it out there and share it with the world.
And then he put it through some sort of Java emulator so that it was just easy to put out a web page, which is quite nice.
So do you feel guilty at all if you drop an egg? Or
kind of never occurred to us, you know.
No. And you may have heard the story that it wasn't originally designed as an egg. It was originally designed as a big face. The sprites have a limited size, and it was something like 24 pixels high by 28 or 30 pixels high.
32, I imagine.
And that was probably. But that was about the only size sprite we could move around the screen. One, because of the speed of plotting pixels, but two, because you need the rest of the screen space to be able to see and navigate. So it was a case of drawing a big face and then go, oh, I've used all the pixel space. I've got no space left. If I make it a little bit smaller and just round off the edges, I can just about put some feet on the bottom of this and put some arms out the side. Yeah. Well, okay, I can't put some arms. I'll put some hands instead. Well, I can't see fingers. We'll call them gloves. And that's how the character was developed. Is everybody else kind of said, it's kind of an egg. It's like,
and it's like, yeah, and we sort like. Of, yeah, that's why. And we sort of went with it. And then that really took off. I mean, one of the things that really helped us, and it's a funny thing, and that is the fact that if we, oh God, what's the descriptive word, adjective that you could use?
Superlative.
Is a positive. So when people were trying to make jokes in reviews and magazines,
it's excellent. Yeah. It's exciting.
Yeah, every sort of eggs that you can think is a positive word. Is a positive word.
And reviewers always wanted to make funny jokes, and it's like, yeah, off you go then, because you'll only be complimenting the game.
Yeah, you can't think of any that sound negative.
And again, that's a very British thing, isn't it? Doing that play on words.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was a complete accident. I mean, we just got lucky.
There was one of your games, Fruit Machine Simulator, that had quite a tragic story behind that game. What happened with it?
Well, what actually happened there was that Codemasters had quite a lot of simulator games, and they were all quite popular, and obviously we did quite a few of them. The artist, Jim Wilson, who was actually doing loading screens for us, a Grand Prix Simulator screen and a few others.
He was a frustrated game designer.
He was. So he decided to do a full game design of a Fruit Machine as a simulator game, which we thought was a bit strange. But anyway,
really into fruit machines. He wanted to design a game, and he goes, I'm going to design the ultimate fruit machine.
Yeah. So we were just fine, and we could see what he was doing. I mean, we visited Codemasters sort of once a month or something. We could see what he was doing.
And whenever he didn't have work, he'd be doing bits and pieces of this design.
So anyway, one of the programmers, the guy Mark Baldock, who actually wrote the Spectrum Robin Hood, after finishing Robin Hood, decided to write the fruit machine that on the Spectrum that Jim Wilson had done. Jim was a really, really friendly guy. I think he was 19. And just as the game was being released, I'm not even sure he saw it released, they were having a big party. It was about Christmas time. And they were down on the south coast.
Lyme Regis.
And they were drinking heavily. And unfortunately, at 2 o'clock in the morning or something, he actually fell off the pier wall into the sea.
It's a harbour wall, but Lyme Regis, yeah. And everyone was too drunk to save him, and he was too drunk to get to the beach.
Yeah. So unfortunately, he died, which is incredibly sad, and we just couldn't believe it, and we were devastated.
But we decided that we weren't terribly impressed with how it was going on the Spectrum, and we decided that we'd write the Amstrad one, and we'd make the best we could of this design that he'd sort of.
And then do a dedication to him and sort of give the royalties to his family.
Nice legacy for him, yeah.
Yeah, but it was a very, very sad. I mean, he was right at the start of his life, and he was a life and soul of the party. Really, really nice guy. Talented artist.
The most horrific funeral we've ever been to.
You go to a funeral of a 19-year-old.
Mm-hmm. All school friends and everyone was just crying the entire time. And it was like, oh, good grief. Whereas you go to funerals usually of old people and everyone's going, well, they had a good innings. Mm-hmm. And, oh, it's nice to see you. I haven't seen you for a while. Yeah, it's nice to have these family get-togethers. But you suddenly, and it wasn't family, but it was just
it was dreadful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was horrible.
Well, obviously, after the 8-bit platforms, you guys moved on to working on the Amiga and the Atari ST. What did you think of those machines?
The only reason we had an Amiga was because of D-Paint. We needed D-Paint to draw graphics for the NES. Because we decided that we were a bit late to the market on the ST and Amiga.
It was just a piracy thing. Everyone who had an ST and Amiga, come around, I've got like this whole rack of discs with games on. It was just like the biggest piracy racket ever. And we were like, how the hell do you ever sell a game on the ST and Amiga? Mm-hmm. It's like, we weren't very good at graphics. Because you didn't really have an artist at that point. I mean, it says art was done in our games, but that generally...
They were in the only loading screens.
They were the loading screens. It's like, oh my God, the games on the ST and Amiga actually have proper graphics in-game.
Yeah. All the graphics in all our 8-bit games are me and Andrew drawing them, and we don't consider ourselves artists.
But we'd made the jump to console, and that seemed to be where the consumers were all buying consoles. So we sort of jumped onto the Sega.
Yeah, so we'd gone through the NES, then the Master System, the Game Gear, Game Boy, and then up to the Mega Drive and Genesis, and then on to the PlayStation after that. So actually, we skipped the whole ST and Amiga. We only used Amigas for D-Paint and drawing some graphics for all of our NES games.
But you did mention in there as well about the PlayStation. I know you guys were kind of early advocates of the PlayStation. Were a lot of people sceptical back then?
So, well, what actually happened was that we just sort of fallen out with Codemasters. We'd produced some Mega Drive games or Genesis games, and we now had to look for sort of money from elsewhere and look for publishers elsewhere. And although we kind of could compete on the Mega Drive, We'd seen the fact that cartridges were very expensive and there were lots of issues and lots of problems with them. We also suspected that Sega probably weren't too keen about us because...
We'd been famously sort of...
doing games without their permission, almost.
Via Codemasters.
Yeah. So we kind of thought, well...
We slightly queered our pitch with Nintendo and Sega, felt.
We felt we might have done. We weren't sure. So we just thought, well, Sony has announced this new machine. Let's kind of investigate this. And the minute we started investigating it, it was like, oh my Lord, it's brilliant. Look at the fact that you can save things onto disk. Look how fast they load. Look at this 3D chip and everything. This is amazing.
We were just astounded by the sort of the technical advancement. And I remember going down to a secret meeting which Phil Harrison ran.
Was it Phil Harrison then?
Yeah, it was Phil Harrison. Yeah, Psygnosis, because he was one of the key people at Psygnosis. They bought Psygnosis because they were the sort of leading ST Amiga, and they wanted a sort of a software developer which was on the cutting edge. And so they bought Psygnosis to turn it into the sort of Sony wing. And at that point, Phil Harrison was the main sort of dev director or something of Psygnosis. So he held a secret meeting. There was about 10 different developers there. And they showed us this demo, and it was Wipeout, which was looking pretty damn nice, and this dinosaur. But yeah, so Jurassic Park had just come out in the cinemas, and they just showed this 3D dinosaur, and it was just like, I've never seen anything like that. That's absolutely incredible. So we got a very early PlayStation, which looked like a
dev kit.
Yeah, the dev kit looked like a huge photocopying machine. It was massive, way bigger than a PC box. And we put some demos together, and we went and met some publishers, and it was incredible to sort of walk into like Acclaim or somewhere and say, "Yep, we're writing PlayStation because that's the new computer," and they were like, "No,
not interested.
How on earth does a sort of TV manufacturer think that it's going to compete with Sega and Nintendo? Wow. Like they know games." Like, Sony might be able to produce electronics, but it's never made a console. It's going to fail. And they always
cited
Betamax.
The Betamax.
Yeah, because they said Betamax was very cool. They said every tech person understands that Betamax is obviously superior, but it failed. And they said, so even if you have the argument that the PlayStation is better than the Sega, Mega Drive and Super NES at that point, they said, it's irrelevant because it's about the brand and the gamers all respect Nintendo and Sega. So they just wouldn't back it. And in fact, that was actually the downfall of Acclaim, because Acclaim never, ever went to PlayStation. But the other ones were pretty damn skeptical and going, nah, don't really like it. So we backed it 100%.
Well, you guys have got such a rich history in this industry and so many great stories to tell. And in fact, you've actually got a book coming out about your tales then. Tell us a bit more about this book.
We do. This was a Kickstarter campaign by Chris Wilkins and Roger Keane, who have done lots of books, retro books about the industry, the UK industry predominantly, covering the Spectrum in pixels and Commodore 64 in pixels. And they've done the story of Ocean, the story of US Gold. And we've obviously, we are kind of part of the fabric of the UK games industry, we kept being asked to do pages for these things. And pretty much every single one of those books, we've got some entries in there. And we were signing some of the books for the guy one time, and he came around the office, because he's actually lives relatively close, came around the office, and whilst we were signing all this stuff, we were just chatting and sort of made a joke about, oh, one day somebody will write a book about us. And he goes, oh, really? And he goes, I could do that. And we're like, would you? And it's like, yeah. And we're like, actually, seriously, would you? And he goes, yeah, why not?
And we were thinking, actually, we've got an awful lot of games and an awful lot of stories. And it was kind of, we said, what we'll do is we'll set out to sort of try and paint a picture of the industry as it was kind of in the 80s, that whole back bedroom thing, because it is something that a lot of people who played all those games and got into those early 8-bit games go, so what was it like being on the other side, like on the dev side? Because you hear all the sort of weird, funny, wacky stories, and it's like, well, we're going to write what it was like from our perspective, like the book, which is pretty much like kids at school, like trying desperately hard and failing really badly to finding the darlings at Codemasters, like day one, and then going through quite a sort of rock and roll-y type of experience for a few years.
And then a bit of a roller coaster.
Well, Philip and Andrew, it's been amazing getting your stories and talking to you guys. We really appreciate you coming on the show, and we look forward to reading the book. One final question I've got to ask. Will we ever get a new Dizzy game?
Wow. I don't know. Never say never. I mean, it's really nice that people fondly remember it. What I would say is that
Will we find another game, or will we make another game? They're two different questions.
Exactly, because who knows? There might be another one. I mean, the funny thing is that I do keep absolutely everything. And we have had to do a lot of archive digging recently. Yeah. So that's one thing. But the other thing I would also say is that we can never really compete, and in fact, we're going to make sure that nobody else can either, with Sky Saga. I mean, all of our sort of new creative energies and the massive team that we have here at Radiant Worlds, we just want to make Sky Saga the biggest and best game ever.
And it's this huge fantasy game in this fantasy world, which gives you lots of quests and...
Yeah.
It's something that might be familiar with people, that people might like.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.